famous story of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was one time... Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was one time on the plane, sitting next to a famous irreligious professor. They were both older men, and they were both accompanied with their children. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's children and grandchildren with him, they were mamish fawning over him the whole time, tending to him, trying to figure out everything they could possibly do to him. The whole time they were busy fussing around him. And this professor who was sitting next to him was amazed. And he said, "I wish I'd get that kind of attention from my grandchildren. What's the difference?" So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said, "You know what the difference is? The difference is that you folks believe that man originates from the monkey. So therefore, father, grandfather, great-grandfather is all the closer, that much closer to the ape. What's there to respect? We believe that the further back you go, the closer you are to Har Sinai. And therefore, they're in awe of any previous generation." So the truth is, this is a cute story, but it's really a very, very fundamental point. That Klal Yisrael has always stood in awe of the preceding generations for good reason, as we'll discuss soon. And the truth is that this is also a very, very fundamental point in approaching the study of Tanakh. There is this approach when we're coming to study the stories of our predecessors, of our ancestors. There's this approach, especially see it nowadays, that basically, okay, come on, everybody is human, and we know that there's Chazal and everything, but we want to approach it just as we can understand it on the literal level. Now, that's a very, very, very big mistake. Because let's address the question. Everybody's human, right? Maybe all the different things that it says there are meant to be understood literally. We've already been discussing that the last couple of weeks. But now I really want to focus more on, whereas the last couple of weeks we focused on the style of the Navi, the harshness of the Navi, now I want to really focus on the personalities that we're going to be dealing with when we're learning Tanakh. And here we have to bring it all together. We discussed earlier that the harsh criticisms of the Nevi'im really represented very, very subtle tainus criticisms that they had on the people. Much, much higher standards that they were holding them up to. And the truth is, when we're going to study those standards, we're going to find many of them harsh. And sometimes it'll be a little bit discouraging. So we have to realize that these subtle criticisms that we see leveled against the personalities of Tanakh actually reflect their greatness. Many of these tainus would not be leveled against us. They were leveled against them because these people were really living on a level that they could handle it. These things could be expected of them. So let's answer the question of, at the end of the day, isn't everybody human? And this is really going to be our subject tonight. At the end of the day, isn't everybody human? The answer is yes, everybody's human. But human is not necessarily mean what we think it means. They were not human in the sense that we relate to as human. This sounds like a leap of faith. But really what we're doing is, as we'll show, we're really just connecting to the live Maseiros of Klal Yisrael in relating to and appreciating what our previous generations were about, what our ancestors were about, what the stock that we come from is. Just illustrate this with a humorous little line said by Reb Shlomo Freifeld, but it illustrates so much truth. Reb Shlomo Freifeld was very involved with many Balei Tshuva. He was sitting in his sukkah. His sukkah was lined with many pictures of the great Gedolim from the previous generation. And somebody was sitting in his sukkah and looked up all the pictures, many people from pre-war Europe, and asked him, "Who are these people?" They said, "These people are the members of a race that has gone extinct. The human race." That's really the answer to our question. Were they human? Yes, they were human. But human does not necessarily mean what we know it to be. The human being of yesteryear, today, just like we said, that our experience of this world, our life in this world, is really a very much watered down experience of what this world is really meant to be, quality-wise. Also, the human beings that we know around us are, we're really the residue of the real greatness of what human beings were, of what the Bnei Yisrael were. We have to realize that. Let's not just, again, just like we said yesterday, last week, don't just take the frame of reference we're used to as far as living in this world goes and think that that's how it always was and just view everything in that perspective. Same thing with human beings. Let's not just take what we know human beings to be and assume that everybody was always like that and relate to them that way. Because, first of all, we're never going to get a proper understanding of our ancestors. And second of all, we will never broaden our own horizons. When we really understand the greatness, the immense greatness that the Ben Yisrael carried in earlier times, we can start breaking loose of what we think are simply human limitations. We can start broadening our horizons. We might not be able to reach the unbelievable madrigas that the earlier generations were on, but we can certainly broaden our horizons and get a lot further than we might think that we're capable of. So we start with the famous Maimar Chazal, Mishoinim Kim Alochim Anu Kibnei Adam. Mishoinim Kim Bnei Adam Anu Kachamayim. Chazal said, already they said in their times, if the earlier ones were like malachim, then we're like people. If the earlier times were like people, then we're like donkeys. And then they add, and don't think, we don't even mean the higher level donkey. There was the donkey of Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yor. We're not on that madriga. We're on the madriga of just a regular donkey. That's already Chazal. Okay? Now, first of all, let's understand what that means. What point is Chazal trying to make? Are they like malachim and we're like humans? Or are they like humans and we're like donkeys? Which of the two is it? What's the... If they're like malachim, we're like humans. And if they're like humans, we're like donkeys. So Mikveh Eger said, you know what the pshat is? The pshat is that we decide. If we relate to them like malachim, we can consider ourselves human. If we relate to them like humans, we have to consider ourselves donkeys. Now, it's not just a line. There's a lot of truth in it, like we were saying before. The truth is that human being, the term human being, is a very relative term. You have to know what you're talking about. In as much as they're human beings, we do not qualify as human beings. It's accurate to say that they're human. It's accurate to say. But then we have to realize that what we are does not quite make the greater the human being. In as much as we're relating to them as humans, we have to realize, like Shlomo Freifeld said, that the human race went extinct. We are a... What the atheists call, right, the prehistoric man, we are post-historic man. Basically the same idea, just it's the opposite idea. Right? Remember, man was primitive, not quite developed. That's what we, if we're going to view them as what human beings really are, we are the underdeveloped prehistoric man that the atheists believe in. As we'll show soon. And again, this is not meant to put us down. We're everything we know ourselves to be. But as we'll be showing soon, real concrete examples, these people were simply outside of our frame of reference. So, yeah, if you relate to them as humans, it means that we don't make the grade as humans. You could. If you want to call yourself a human, then you have to realize that there's something superhuman. They're malach. Meaning that yes, the Yetzaharas that we know and the struggles that we're encountering on a day-to-day basis were things that they were way above. We'll just give a couple of examples of things that we actually saw. In order to begin understanding this, let's realize that every generation in Klal Yisrael related to the generation before them with awe. Meaning, those who knew the great people of the previous generation were completely amazed and completely awed by their personalities, by their greatness in very many areas that we'll illustrate. If we understand that that's how it was through every generation, right, the ones that we knew, I'll just give a simple example. When I came to the Mir Yeshiva, I learned under who became my Rebbe in learning, Rebbe Fall Shmuel Levitz. Old Rosh Yeshiva. I had come from a yeshiva with younger Rebbeim, and, you know, good Rebbeim, but, you know, they were humans like me. Meaning, you know, you could argue with them, you could catch them on a point, this, that. I remember coming into his shir, and it was just like being completely blown away. Right, after the first couple of shiurim, first of all, you couldn't catch him on anything. any question that you brought up in the shir, he was basically just saying the tip of the iceberg of everything that was behind the shir. Anytime you tried to catch him on a point, you saw how he had already thought of it and was 10 steps ahead. There was no catching him. It was just like, remember, I heard a different fellow who came with me from the same yeshiva said, it's just not fair, us against him. And anytime, Rabbi Raphael Shmulevitz from the Mir Yeshiva, Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz's oldest son. And so, after a while, we really came to relate to him with awe. He really trained us in learning because, remember, the way I used to think was, anytime when you spoke up in shir, you had to be ready to really be ran over completely. So I remember it really reached a point, he really developed my mind in learning, because I remember when I would sit learning a Gemara, I'd have a certain difficulty, I would ask myself, why am I scared to ask him this question? Obviously there's some hole there, right? I haven't thought it through enough. I had to be very, very confident, and you had to really feel that you had it all worked out well before you even approached him with a question. Right? Because otherwise, you simply felt stupid when he would just, you know, kind of take it apart and show you how you kind of missed the most, some basic points in the sugya. It's trained us to think. Trained us to think. Very much sharpened us. Now, I remember one time when I was sitting with him on the bus. I used to take advantage. I used to go home with him on the bus. I asked him if I could have had some time alone with him. I would talk and learning with him. He lived at that time a little further away from the yeshiva, now he lives next door. And it was a 15-minute ride of quality learning time with him. One time, he was with his brother. It was me, him, and his brother. I kind of sat quietly and basically just kind of listened to their conversation. And they were arguing some point in learning. And then Rabbi Raphael Shmulevitz said to his brother, he made a certain point, and he said, and I have 4 proofs to this. And he made this proof and that proof and that proof. Very dazzling, brilliant proofs. And then he said, but then I have another proof that outweighs them all. I said this to Rav Nachum Pertsovitz. He was the previous generation Rosh Yeshiva in the year. And he agreed. And that, as far as he was concerned, outweighed all the brilliant proofs that he brought. So here I was just expiring. Remember, like, it hit me then. This is what Masaira means. I'm completely in awe of this man. I think that, you know, as far as learning goes, he's the final word. And here I see him relating to Rav Nachum Pertsovitz in the same way. I have all my brilliant cheshbonos, but forget all that. Put all that aside. Rav Nachum Pertsovitz agreed to this. So yeah, that's how it worked in Klal Yisrael. People, we're not talking about an issue of faith. We're told, oh, these people are very great people and believe it. We're working on experience. People who have been exposed to the great people of Klal Yisrael in their generation relate to them with awe. We see what they're made out of. And we know that they related to those before them in a way that were nothing compared to them. And that's the way it worked all the way up. So if we continue in this style, so Rav Nachum Pertsovitz related to his Rebbe, Rav Baruch Ber Leibovich, with that same just absolute bittul. And Rav Baruch Ber Leibovich was famous the way he related to his Rebbe, Reb Chaim Brisker. It goes back. The way Reb Chaim Volozhiner related to the Vilna Gaon. It goes back. Every generation related to those before them with the utmost awe. Because they knew these people and they saw how much further they were from them. If we see the ones that we were zeichet to be exposed to, we say how far we are from them. We see the way they're relating to the ones above them and they're relating to the ones above them. We start understanding that David HaMelech was a little bit more than just the colorful character we see when we're learning Tanakh in a basic way. If the Vilna Gaon, who we all just stand gaping, right, related to Chazal with just open-eyed amazement, and they related to David HaMelech with that open-eyed amazement, which is again based on the fact that they were exposed to people who were exposed to people who were exposed to people who were exposed to him. We're understanding that we're dealing with a personality that's simply beyond comprehension. I just want to illustrate a little bit. I want to really bring home this point to really appreciate what it means to be relating to people who we simply don't comprehend. Let's go back to the term that Chazal used. If the Rishonim are like people, we are like donkeys. There's a lot of profundity in that statement. It's not just, again, the sharp line, but, you know, And we're like donkeys, and not even like the donkey of a Pinchas Ben Yair. There's a lot of profundity to that statement. Let's think about that for a minute. You step out onto the street, you're a human being. You step out onto the street with a donkey. You're walking with a donkey down the street. Okay? Walk onto the street, what do you expect to see in a street? There are cars, there are street signs, right? There are advertisements. So you step out onto the street, there's all kinds of things going on around you. Right? Car means something to you. If a person goes, psst, you're being addressed. Right? You automatically feel like someone's calling you. Street signs. You look at one, you laugh. You look at the other one, you get annoyed. Right? Depending on what it says on the signs, right? The different posters that you see in the streets. Now, that donkey, is he anywhere near your experience when he's walking through the street? What does he see? The car is just a hunk of blue. That's all it means to him. He doesn't see a vehicle of transportation. He sees blue. Street signs mean nothing at all to him. So he's completely not attuned to everything that's going on around him, right? Well, look at a book. You read a page. If you know the language, the page is alive, right? You read a page in a book. You could be laughing, crying, getting annoyed, getting happy, right? You have a donkey looking at the page. Let's say he sees you laughing and he understands at least what it means that you're laughing. He just doesn't understand what it is. You're both looking at the same page. He sees the same thing that you see. You see words. You see a whole story. He sees black and white. And he doesn't understand. Why is this black and white making you cry? This black and white is making you laugh. This black and white is making you shake your head. And this black and white is making you nod your head. It's all the same. He's completely not experiencing what you're experiencing by just looking around him. Right? This is an example of two, well, creatures. We'll call the donkey a person now, okay? Two people who are in completely different worlds, even though they're in the same place. Right? Because one is attuned to the significance of everything going on around him, and the other is not. The other is just completely in the dark. So, we have to realize that when we're talking about the great people of the previous generations, this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about people besides what we described last week as a different reality of what this world really was. We're talking about people who were much more attuned. Their sensitivities were so much finer that they were experiencing a completely different world. Even if they would live in our world, forget what we discussed last week about how the quality of this world was different. Even if they were living in our world, they were attuned to the spiritual reality of everything going on around them. You might call it hyper alert. They were just aware of so much more. And again, right now we're still talking a little abstract. We'll illustrate a bit more as we go on. That we're really talking about, if we're talking about us as opposed to them, we're talking about donkeys as opposed to human beings, as far as the level of being attuned to the reality of what's going on around you. Be able to hear things, to be able to sense things, to be able to see things in the right way. Just want to tell a few stories, just to illustrate just what we're trying to bring across of how you can have people who we were exposed to representing the greatness of previous, just one generation back, a couple of generations back, and start getting an idea of what it means if people are on a completely different level of awareness. A completely different level of consciousness. Completely different levels of discipline. I want to use a few examples just in order to get my point across in a few different fields, just in order to really begin to appreciate that there are, even when we're dealing with people who are not so long ago, people we might have known, we're talking about people living in a completely different sphere than we are. I want to show it in a few different areas. Let's start with discipline. In order to really start getting an appreciation of the discipline of the people in earlier generations, let's understand that it's something that is completely out of our frame of reference. It's the famous Kelm Yeshiva. Kelm Yeshiva, they were training the Talmidim to levels of self-discipline, of self-control. See soon, we would consider completely extreme. But this was the levels of the previous generation. Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz told that when he first came to the Kelm Yeshiva, he was very interested in seeing the Rosh Yeshiva, was the Alter from Kelm, Rabbi Simcha Zissel Ziv, one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He said, in Kelm though, you did not make one move that wasn't calculated. To the extent that if a person lifted his eyes from the Siddur in Ma'ariv, that was a taboo. To lift your eyes, to look around during Ma'ariv, why are you looking around? What for? Is there a specific reason for it? If not, why are you doing it? So he said he came in, he was very, very eager to see the Alter from Kelm, the Rosh Yeshiva. But the atmosphere was such in the yeshiva that he sat through Ma'ariv, sitting opposite the Alter from Kelm. He didn't see his face until after Ma'ariv because people did not lift their eyes from the Siddur. I'll take it another step. Rabbi Eli Lapian also came to the Kelm Yeshiva. When he came for his first day in the yeshiva, he came into a lecture from the Alter. He was standing in the back. He was a new Talmud. He was standing in the back and he bit his nails. Oh boy. In Kelm, you didn't bite your nails. Unless you had a very, very serious and necessary reason to. Right? Biting nails was the epitome of lack of self-discipline. Lack of control. Why is a person biting his nails? So he was standing in the back of the Midrash biting his nails, and the Alter from Kelm saw him. And he opened up such a tirade, and he went on and on and on, and basically dedicated the rest of his lecture to lambasting Rav Eli Lapian over the head, completely tearing him apart, saying, is that how you would stand at Har Sinai? Like this? When you're facing Hashem? When you're hearing a shir from a Rebbe, you're being mekabel the Torah from Sinai. You think that that's how Kol Yisrael stood? He's going on and on, tearing him apart. Now, you would think, terribly humiliated in front of everybody. Rav Eli Lapian said that in the half hour that this went on, not one of the boys in the Beis Medrash turned his head around to see who was being yelled at. Nobody knew who he was yelling at. Nobody turned their head. That was the discipline of Kelm. This is the discipline of 100 years ago. The Talmidim of Kelm were people that we've seen. Rav David Pavarsky, Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, who was nifter about 15 years ago. Person we've seen. I saw him. Many people have seen him. This was a person who, still in our generation, was living those standards. The Talmidim said that they were one time walking with him. Again, no movement was done without a reason. He didn't move without a reason. What did you move for? They were walking with him home once, and he passed under, right, the classic scenario. You pass under a housewife's porch while she's doing sponja, and she's sweeping the water off the porch onto the street beneath. So he had the bad luck of passing underneath a woman's porch while she was doing sponja. Boom, he got a whole shower. Shower, head to toe, he's drenched. The Talmidim said it was mind-boggling. He didn't lift his head, he just simply turned around and walked back home. Within a split second, what went through his mind? There's no, what's the person looking up? Is that going to make me dry? What do I need to do? I'm wet. I need to change my clothing. Looking up has nothing to do with that. He turned around without lifting his head. Just because there was no reason to. Turned around and walked back home and changed. Only the most natural thing in the world. He's wet and he goes back home. These are things that it's very, very, very difficult to relate to, but these are things that we've seen in people our generation. Reb Simcha Zissel Broide, Rosh Hashiva of Chevron, was also nifter about 15 years ago. The level of discipline, of self-control, of human respectability. Whenever he spoke to a person, he never turned his head to the person. Whenever he spoke to a person, he faced the person full. Now, this was a person, he was a Rosh Yeshiva of a very, very big yeshiva. Talmidim used to tell, in amazement, how after a shir, he would be surrounded by Talmidim on all sides, all asking questions at the same time. But he would stand like this, face the person who's asking. As it was finished, he would turn this way, never turned just his head to face a person and talk to him. Whenever he spoke to somebody, he faced him with his whole body. Whenever somebody called him in the street, turned his whole body around. It was never just an impulsive turning of the head. And if something wasn't relevant, then again, the same thing. There was noise, yelling this, he never turned his head. If there was a need to face somewhere else, he turned his entire body. It was always a thought-out action. We saw the same thing with Rabbi Avigdor Miller also. His tiniest moves were measured. These are just some examples. I'm spending a lot of time on this because I really want to hammer home the point that we have to realize that even if we're just talking a couple of generations back, we're talking about concepts of greatness, of human greatness that are beyond us. I want to demonstrate in a couple of other areas also. Sensitivity. Sensitivity to other people. It's also amazing sometimes when we see people from these last couple of generations, but the genius that went into the, how attuned they were to the people around them with such a high genius level, is also things that's very hard to relate to. A couple of examples of this also. Reb Leib Gurwitz was the Rosh Yeshiva of Gateshead. Also Nifter, I'm not sure, 15, 20 years ago, something like that. He was, in the Gateshead Yeshiva, there was a library, right, Eitzes Farim. And the minig in the yeshiva was that the older boys in the yeshiva would lock themselves in the library and lock the younger boys out in the late hours of the evening. When there were no rabbanim in the yeshiva, that was the way it works. The older guys would kind of just lock out the younger guys and they would do their thing in the library. Obviously, minig couldn't have lasted if there were any rabbanim in the yeshiva at the time, but this was late at night when there weren't rabbanim in the yeshiva. One time, Reb Leib Gurwitz was learning at home. He came in, he needed a book from the yeshiva library. And at that time, there were a couple of older guys who had locked themselves in the library and they weren't letting anybody in. So he came to the library, knocks on the door. Who's there? Leib Gurwitz. The guys inside were sure that it's a couple of younger kids trying to get in. These things went on every night. They said, yeah, Leib Gurwitz, you can go back home. So you know, he knocks again. And he once again says, please let me in. I want to get a safer. It's really me. Yeah, we know. This goes back and forth a couple of minutes until suddenly one of them says to the other, maybe it's really him. And they realized that it was. And now they didn't know what to do. They were mortified. Okay, they're obviously going to open the door now. Completely mortified, right? Obviously. They open the door, and Reb Leib Gurwitz is standing like this with his hand covering his eyes, and he steps back for them to be able to get by without him seeing them. Who would think of that? I think the best I would do is that when they open the door, I'd smile and say, don't feel bad. I understand it was a mistake. Who would think of that on the spot? Standing there with his eyes covered. Another example. This is Zalman Meltzer. Okay, he was Nifter more than 10, 15 years ago. He was Nifter about 50 years ago. But again, people today have known him. People today have known him. He gave the shir in Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. As a person who gives a shir, I can really appreciate this story. He gave the shir in Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. That was the biggest yeshiva in Yerushalayim at the time. And when he gave his shir, it was a very, very big collection of people, Talmidim of the yeshiva, and all kinds of different Yerushalmis used to come in off the street to hear the shir. And I know that when I'm giving a shir, even if I'm smiling and stuff, I'm making confession here, I'm tense, I'm nervous, you know, and I'm very focused. Okay? So, I appreciate this story. But, he's giving a shir, he always gave a very, very high level shir, very deep shir. And his style was, like many of the great Rosh Yeshiva, that he considered himself, he was able to take on other mefarshim, and you know, he had his own derech in the Gemara, and it didn't bother him if other mefarshim in the last 100-150 year range weren't like him. He had his derech. They said not like me. They said not like me. I can disagree. And all the time he didn't do that. No, you didn't challenge him in the shir with one of the achronim. Just okay. That's what he says. This is what I said. Okay. Now, one day in the shir, one of the weaker boys suddenly spoke up and said, as he was giving a certain understanding, a certain interpretation, one of the boys spoke up and says, you know, the Tesfas Emes says otherwise. So Mr. Zalman said, whoa, really? Like, he looked a little intimidated. What is it? What does the Tesfas Emes say? And the boy told him what the Tesfas Emes says. Mr. Zalman said, I didn't know that Tesfas Emes. I don't know what to say. You got me. And he moved on to the next point. All the Talmidim was surprised, but it was very much not his style. And I said, okay, so Tesfas Emes is what he says, I say what I say, you know. So, very much not his style. So one of the Talmidim asked him about it after the shiur. Why did the Rebbe back down because of Tesfas Emes? You know, you're always able to hold your own against the other Achronim. So he said, this boy never speaks up in shiur. Now, I noticed today that an older man, a stranger, was not usually come to this shiur, was in the Beis Medrash when I was giving the shiur. When this boy spoke up, it dawned on me that maybe that fellow was a prospective father-in-law who was coming to check him out. And this boy knew about it, and that's why he wanted to show off. So he was asking that question in order to make an impression on the guy watching him. And that's why I responded the way I did. When a person is completely engrossed in a shiur, I know what it means. When a person is involved with giving a shiur and he's focused and everything, all that should go through his mind in that split second, and it turned out that it was true. A couple of days later, this guy was engaged to that fellow's daughter. These are things that are beyond my comprehension, at least. This is the reason that we relate to these people with awe. We're talking about people that we just can't begin to comprehend. One last example, which I want to lead up to with another story. One last person, two stories. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. Let's make sure I have enough time to get where we want to get. But Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was, right, the famed Rav from Yerushalayim, also Nifter about 80 years ago. Yerushalayim in those days was a very, very poor city. Poor city. And much of the populace in Yerushalayim before what they call the Aliyah Shnia, before the second wave of people started coming from Europe, was mainly older Rabbanim who basically retired and wanted to spend the rest of their lives learning, didn't need much. Okay. And you had to have some means of Parnassa there, but it was very, very minimal. There was one Rav from Europe who wanted to do that. He wanted to basically retire, stop being a Rav, come to Yerushalayim and spend the rest of his life. He heard that in Yerushalayim there weren't many glaziers. So he decided maybe that's where I can make my parnasa. He knew the trade. Came to Yerushalayim, be a glazier, and he'll spend his time learning. What?
A glazer?
Yeah, glazer. Is that how you say it? A glass maker. Window. Makes windows. Yerushalayim, they weren't really making fancy glass things. Makes windows. And when he came to Yerushalayim, he discovered why they weren't glaziers. People didn't have glass windows. They didn't need glaziers. In the winter, you put a board over the window. In the summer, you took off the board, and that was that. Nobody had glass windows. So he came with his tools and with everything. No business. After a little while, you know, once he made the trip, it wasn't the plane ride back. He's kind of stuck. He's got a family, and there's no parnasa. So as much as he didn't like it, this is what he was trying to avoid. He figured his only other means of parnasa is to get some sort of rabbinic position. So he decided he has to show himself off a little bit. He has to, you know, kind of make himself known a little bit. Problem is, he's in Yerushalayim. Every other person is a very heavy-duty Torah authority. So he decided to make the rounds among some of the noted, famous Talmid Chachamim of Yerushalayim, to come talk with them and learning, show his prowess. How do you say it?
Prowess.
So, he made the rounds, he had a few good discussions, he's hoping he's making headway with some of the different Rabbanim in Yerushalayim, a lot of heated back and forth, he felt that he made a good impression, he's hoping that he's going to be getting around. And went to a few, four, five, six Rabbanim, had very exciting, heated, long discussions with them. He's hoping he's making it in. Then he comes to Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. starts giving his whole discourse to Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld with all the fire, and Rabbi Yosef Chaim listens to him the whole time without saying a word. Listens quietly until he's finished, and then he says, "Tell me, how's Parnassah?" So this Rav afterwards, okay, he confessed. And Rabbi Yosef Chaim immediately arranged for a position in one of the neighborhoods. So the Rav came afterwards and said, "The only person who really understood my Torah was Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld." Again, we're talking about people are attuned to what's going on with the other person on a very, very high level. And this same Rabbi Yosef Chaim, and here we get back to the self-discipline point, this same Rabbi Yosef Chaim was in charge of the Tzedakah Fund in Yerushalayim. This is also something that's going to sound harsh. This same Rabbi Yosef Chaim, with all that sensitivity, he had a very rigid policy. And that was, he wants to be 100% sure that he's not making any decisions in his administrating of the Tzedakah funds based on partiality. And therefore, not one cent went to his family. Not one cent went to his family. If people in his family needed, he would tell them, "I can give you my own money, but not from the Tzedakah fund." He was supporting many poor people around Yerushalayim. Nothing for his family. Harsh. Harsh. But we're seeing here levels of people who the sensitivity, along with that absolute sense of responsibility of making sure I'm going to be clean, there's not going to be any chashash that I'm going to be doing anything based on partiality. These are levels of people that we're dealing with. These are things that are beyond at least my frame of reference to be able to relate to the way the minds or the levels of alertness, levels of consciousness that these people have. And here we're talking about a span of all these different stories that we told, people who are nifter from 20 to 80 years ago. This is one generation back. Two generations back. And the people from those times related to the people before them in the same way. They couldn't comprehend them. If we're going a little further back, we're going to really start talking about things that we mamish can't comprehend. Rabbi Baruch Ben Leibovich, also nifter, probably 90 years ago. This was a person who every time he said the name of Hashem, trembled. Every time he said the name of Hashem, trembled. Can we begin to relate to that? Obviously, we're talking about a person who's living on a level of consciousness, of an awareness of Hashem, in such a sensory way that he really felt it. How could I dare say the name? But I'm supposed to say it. He said it with trepidation. Every time he said the name of Hashem. And here, I want to draw on another story that this, I don't know if it happened or not. I don't know if it's true. But it's certainly told. And there are many stories. This I heard a great man say a very, very wise point. Said, the stories that I tell, I don't know if they actually happened or not, but they're all true. Meaning, the point of a story is its point. And this story is a very, very true point. One of the Rebbes said, one of the earlier Rebbes, from earlier back, said that he one time asked a special request Mita Shemayim to experience the Rambam's Yiras Shemayim. To experience the Rambam's fear of Hashem. And he said, immediately after he asked that, he suddenly went into a certain seizure and collapsed in a dead faint. Meaning that the Rambam, the consciousness of Hashem and the fear of Hashem, the Rambam was living with and walking around with serenely on a regular level, on a regular basis, was something that a person 500 years later couldn't bear for a minute. Now, I don't know if the story is true. I don't know if he collapsed in a dead faint. But the point of the story is very, very fundamental for what we're trying to do when we're really starting to approach the earlier generations. This is how it was. These people were walking around on a level of consciousness that is completely beyond our comprehension. If we spoke about Rabbi Baruch Ben Leibovich, who trembled every time he said Hashem's name 90 years ago, and we're supposed to take it further back, another 90 years, and another 90 years, and another 90 years, until we get back to the time of the Amoraim, back to the time of the Tanoim, back to the time of the personalities of Chazal, we're dealing with people that are completely outside of our frame of reference. If we're going to start talking about Chazal, mamish see that we're way up and above. One of the Amoraim, right? The end of Chazal. Fasted for 40 days. Why? Because he accidentally made the bracha on the tefillin without realizing that the strap was inside out. And you're not really yet to the mitzvah that way. What do we do if we discover that it's inside out? You turn it back, right? What did he do? He fasted for 40 days. If he fasted for 40 days because one time he put on his tefillin with the strap inside out, he wasn't fasting his whole life. You can imagine what his record looked like. I think we would all be able to be very proud of such a record, that basically what we needed to fast for 40 days was the fact that one time we put on our tefillin and the strap was backwards. And that's how we said the bracha. This is very, very important to realize that when we're approaching the personalities of the Tanakh, we're approaching with an axiom, which is not a leap of faith. It's not a leap of faith, but rather it's connecting to the live Masorah of the people that we're coming from, who ultimately knew these people. We're approaching with an axiom that these are people who are completely outside our frame of reference, and that anything we're going to be talking about, we're going to approach them with the utmost reverence. We're not going to be able to measure their deeds in terms of the way we would feel about it, in terms of the way it appears to us. We have to approach realizing that we're dealing with much, much subtler criticism, even when it's going to, we'll see. Even when it says very blatant things, this one was Avodah Zarah, that one was Mezaneh, right? So last week, Shlomo was built an altar for Avodah Zarah. David HaMelech did Znus, right? We have to realize that we're approaching with such subtle levels of criticism that reflect greatness that's way beyond our comprehension. And by being able to relate to this that way, we'll be able to get what Hashem really wants us to get out of Tanakh. Not just a bunch of historic studies and historic data that doesn't really have any relevance to anything. The point is to really start tapping into the greatness that we come from, to start broadening our horizons, to start realizing the standards of excellence that Klal Yisrael could live to. And that's really the purpose of Tanakh. The purpose of Tanakh is to connect to the live line of greatness that Klal Yisrael is. That'll be that for this week. I believe that we'll start Yeshua probably the week after next. Next week, one more week of preface.
Next week is...
Oh, that's so sorry.